Silver Lake Public Library presents Silver Lake Stories, a community-driven oral history project collecting stories about people, places, and events then and now of Silver Lake, Kansas.
What story were you going to tell me about, or what history?
We're going to talk about the Kansas River.
Okay.
And a couple of different aspects.
Okay, what would you like to tell me about it?
Well, one thing people need to understand about Silver Lake Lake, it is, as far as I can tell from older maps and reading, it is an oxbow, which makes sense. Oxbows are when a river ages and they start getting curves in them. And when you look at the photographs of the aerial photographs that hang in the City Hall meeting room, you can see that there are filled-in oxbows to the west of Silver Lake Lake. And as near as I can tell from research, that lake has been there about 200 years. How long it's actually been there, who knows? But when a river floods, it will often cut off an oxbow to straighten the river again to make it more free-flowing. And there is another little oxbow south of Silver Lake and just east. And in the 1951 and the 1993 flood, it made a determined effort to cut that oxbow out and straighten the river channel. But in neither one of those floods, it didn't have enough water power to do it. But there will be a flood that will come and straighten out that channel again. And there'll be another little spot that'll straighten itself out and be a curve. They look little crescents when you look at the aerial photographs. And they, over time, over the centuries, will fill with sediment. And what's washed in from higher ground down into the valley, and they fill in, and they just become a part of the valley. And people often don't look at that from the history of how rivers create themselves and how floods change those channels.
Oh.
If they really want to see a unique cutout, everyone says the river channel is the boundary line between Pottawatomie County and Waubunsee County over south of St. Mary's. And that is true. But the 1903 flood changed the channel. And the channel there was sort of a curve inward and away from the main channel. And the 1903 essentially straightened it out. And if you drive over a bridge there right south of St. Mary's now, you drive over what was originally the river. And it's been slowly filling in and with trees growing in the bottom of it now for over a century. The other thing we're going to talk about today is how Silver Lake almost came to be just a footnote in history.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
In 1929, the United States had a stock market crash. The country went into a severe depression. Most people know that from history. They don't often know about a little footnote in history about the idea of Lake Cairo. When Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 32 and came into office in 33, one of the things they immediately started looking for was projects that the government could do that could help people, but also help the unemployment situation, which was something they were desperately trying to do.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of talk about where can we build dams. And one of the reasons they were looking at the Kansas River, among others, was the Great Flood of 1927, which was at that time considered the worst flood in the history of the Mississippi. And the folks down south wanted the government to do something on the about slowing the water going into the Mississippi from every major river. And that included the Missouri. Kansas River runs into the Missouri River. And so there was discussion about putting a dam at somewhere in the central part of Missouri on the Missouri River, one on the Missouri River at approximately about 40 miles, I think it was, north of the Nebraska border. Mm-hmm. And then one of the places they suddenly were talking about was Lake Cairo, which would put a dam across the river valley here near us between both bluffs and flood the Kansas River Valley from Cairo to almost Manhattan. There was immediately instant conflict. The pro-dam folks versus, no, you're not going to take my land and my business for a lake fight continued. And it started in 33. And in some ways, it didn't really end until 37, though officially the Corps of Engineers, from their point of view, had ruled out Lake Cairo in 35. But there were federal hearings. They had one of the first big meetings in, I think it was October of 33, at the Topeka Auditorium. That was a front page spread in the Topeka papers. Yeah. And the auditorium was filled with people on both sides. And there were numerous private groups wanting the lake. There were numerous people who didn't want the lake. At the very beginning, Topeka, Lawrence, and Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas, chambers of commerce were all for Lake Cairo. But it didn't take long to break up that little partnership of people, because suddenly there was the idea of putting a dam at Fort Peck in Montana. And they continued to argue and talk and have hearings. And what it finally came down to for Corps of Engineers, which is the Army Corps of Engineers, was money. They decided they wanted Fort Peck because it was going to take millions and millions of dollars just to move Highway 24.
Yeah.
And the railroads that people often don't think about. We have railroads that run on the north side of the river, east and west. There are also a railroad that runs south on the south bluff, east and west.
Mm-hmm.
And they suddenly realized how much money it was going to take to move all the infrastructure and the adverse impact that was going to have. They also had huge resistance from the towns up and down the valley, Silver Lake, Rossville, Bellevue, Wamego, even Little Cairo, which had their feed store, wasn't too enthused about getting wiped out for a dam. And farmers and ranchers that had been in this valley, some cases they'd already been here, their families had been here since the 1860s and 70s, they didn't want to lose their land. And so in the end, they finally decided that Fort Peck was a more reasonable cost project. Also, part of that land up there was already owned by the federal government, and the state of Montana supported it, and the locals supported it because it was a relatively small population that was going to be dispersed because of it. But if they had decided that Lake Cairo was the choice project, Silver Lake would just have been a footnote in history.
That is very interesting. I did not know that.
Do you know about the 1844 flood?
I don't think so.
Okay. You know, our knowledge of the floods here in the valley from the Kansas River only happened when basically Europeans got here. There's stories from the Native American tribes that were here, but 1844 actually had a few more people out here watching it. And of course, this was before there were any reservoirs. But 1844 flooded not just here on the Kansas River, but like the Meredosine, and all the major rivers here in northeastern Kansas flooded that year. And there are reports in military records and from Indian missionaries that it flooded the Kansas River Valley from bluff to bluff.
Oh, wow.
People forget how powerful that river that's south of us here can be.
Mm-hmm.
We think nature is benign. No, nature is not benign, as we all learned the other night during our windstorm here in Silver Lake.
Yeah.
And so we need to always keep in mind what we're thinking we really want in relationship to understanding that Silver Lake and this valley is a floodplain. Just because it hasn't flooded really bad for a lot of years doesn't mean that it cannot happen again.
Because when was the last time it really flooded? 1960s?
You had the 1993 flood.
1990s, okay.
It wasn't as bad in Silver Lake as it might have been if it had been 1951. But the levee did break several places from between St. Mary's and Silver Lake. And there's the infamous photograph of a farmer and his family water skiing in his soybean field over by Rossville, which, of course, brought lots of chuckles, but it showed the power of the river. Because one of the things that's happened after the 51 flood, which did flood downtown Silver Lake, was that the farmers in the neighborhoods got together and created drainage districts. And we tax ourselves to build levees along the river from Silver Lake to some place around St. Mary's, because once you get west of St. Mary's and a little south, which is where the river's at, there are no levees in that neighborhood. But 93, there was a spot where it's trying to make that cut and end that oxbow down on one of the local roads down here, that there was a sand boil. And it was essentially water pressure coming up and creating a almost fountain effect and turning the road into sand. And several houses along that road, you had pressure coming up from underneath and trying to lift the houses out of the ground. Even our house, which is about a mile from that particular curve in the river, in 93, we wound up with a hairline crack across the basement floor.
Oof.
From the water pressure underneath.
Yeah.
And we had moved out and had our furniture someplace else. And I would go every day and check the house. And I remember getting out of the car one day and going around the side of the garage, and there in the sidewalk going to the back door, there was like a 6-9-inch water fountain.
Oh, my gosh.
And that day I took a sponge from the kitchen counter, kitchen sink, and threw it just on the ground and went in and checked the house and checked the basement to make sure we didn't have water in it. And when I came out, you could wring the water out of the sponge because the water table was essentially at ground level.
Oh my gosh.
And people who've not seen that kind of thing happen in this valley really don't have a good understanding of it. And they have to respect the Kansas River. I was going to mention Mr. Helm, who's up at the cemetery, to make sure everybody knew we had a Medal of Honor winner from the Civil War buried in our cemetery. Have you ever been to Vicksburg?
No, I have not.
Battlefield there is always very interesting. But they had trenches. And the Union guys were digging their trenches, getting closer and closer and closer to the artillery of the Confederates. And it finally got to the point that they were so close to the Confederates that the Confederates could not aim their cannon into the trenches anymore and kill the Union guys. And so that day, there I don't remember how many men were ordered out into the trenches. And they carried cannonballs with them. And they would stick their fuse in their cannonball. And they would throw it at the Confederates. And for all day, the Confederates would catch them and throw the lit cannonballs back on the Union guys. And whoever had the hot potato when it exploded were the ones who were killed.
Oh, geez.
And the Union guys that came back that night that had not died were all awarded medals of honor. And he was one of them. And he's buried up at our cemetery.
Okay. Yeah, see, I did not know that.
Well, Francis knew it because he took me up there one Memorial Day weekend not long after we were married. Well, you need to see this one. And I said, okay, why do I need to see? Oh, you got yourself a Medal of Honor winner. He said, yeah, I don't know why you got it. And I said, well, I'm sure there's something at work somewhere. And over my lunchtime for the next few weeks, I studied